As you're turning to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 4 through 6, give you just a little tidbit to think about. If you were to take a person's life and look at different snapshots, you'd find good and bad. You find that that's also true for Paul as far as his letters. Sometimes he gets into a doctrinal discussion. Sometimes you find other matters, as we're going to look at in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where he talks about his life, some of the things that he did, some of the things that he avoided, sometimes some of the struggles he had. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he's still defending himself against some of the people who oppose some of his work at Corinth. And you find in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that he's saying that he has certain rights. We talked about that a little bit from 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Paul talked about the strong and the weak and the fact that the strong had the right to eat meat and the weak did not. And in 1 Corinthians 9, the text that we're going to look at tonight, he's focused on two things. He's going to focus on the right to get married, to have a wife, to have a family, and he's also going to talk about the right as far as being a preacher to be paid. And you see the point starting in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 4. He says, have we not the right to eat and drink? That is, don't we have the right to be paid for the work that we do? He's not talking about the right to literally eat and drink. Everybody, of course, has that, or otherwise they die. And then he says in verse 5, have we not the right to lead about a wife that is a believer, even as the rest of the apostles and the brethren of the Lord and Cephas, or Peter? Or I only and Barnabas, have we not a right to forbear working? As you think about paying people for the work that they do, preaching, of course, falls into that same category. And as you think about the Corinthians, Paul brings this up perhaps because they lived in a very pagan culture. When you look at Corinth, it was a culture, it was a city that was plagued with idolatry. We've talked before about the Temple of Aphrodite there. There were 1,000 pagan priestesses, so idolatry was rampant in the city. And when you have idolatry, you, of course, have priests. And if you are involved with paganism, you're going to make sacrifices to the gods. Probably what are your sacrifices going to often involve? You're going to have a drink offering, but there are going to be a lot of offerings which involve what kind of sacrifice? You're going to bring meat. All right, if it's your job as a priest to accept the sacrifices that people bring in, and people are bringing in meat, guess what eventually becomes a problem for you? I mean, maybe the first sheep or bunch of cattle that come in, you know, you can eat off that for a little while, maybe give some away from friends. But if this is your job 5, 6, 7 days a week, eventually what's going to happen?
Surplus.
You're going to have a surplus. And they didn't have the kinds of storage that we have today as far as freezers and other options. So they developed meat markets, and there are some historical sources which talk about those meat markets being adjacent to the temple, those kinds of things. And if you essentially turn out to be a meat salesman, and that's kind of what happened with these guys because they're getting so much, what does that do to your bottom line eventually? Are you going to be a poor priest, or are you going to be a rich priest? You're going to be a rich priest. If you have people in a culture who are accustomed to seeing very wealthy priests, very wealthy religious workers, then when some guy shows up and he starts preaching the gospel, your mind is probably going to go where? Hey, this guy is preaching for what reason? He's in it for
money.
He's in it for the money, right? And when you see all these other people, that's how they're making a very good living. That would have been a natural thought. Well, how might you deal with that if you're Paul? I mean, you don't want to be categorized in the same grouping as those pagan priests. So if you really want to tell the people that you're not in it for the money, what might you do?
Find another source.
You might find another source of income. You might pick up support from other places. And we know that there were times in Paul's life when he did that. Brian?
I just take none of their money.
Take none of their money. Yeah, and that's ultimately the choice that he makes. So there is no way that they can make any kind of charge against him. So it does seem like that was his choice. He says to the Corinthians, pay me nothing, don't want a single dime, not a single penny from you. And that allowed him to draw a clear line between himself and others.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Paul is teaching the gospel. He's not teaching them to sacrifice and stuff. So if he doesn't have any animals that he's having them bring to him to sacrifice, they should know that he's not selling it.
You would think.
He doesn't have
the wherewithal that the priest would. Yeah.
He doesn't have product.
Yeah. You would think, as far as all the teaching about New Testament giving, that he would have covered those. Well, I mean, we know that he covered those things, at least in this letter. And you would think that they had an understanding of that, given as you've been prospered. You got the 2 Corinthians letter as well that comes along a little bit later. But it looks like he just went to the nth degree or extreme to say, I am in a completely different category. Now, you would hope that if somebody does that, people get it. But it looks like, as you look at this chapter in this letter, that there were some people who either didn't get it or they didn't want to get it. Because there were some individuals who used his good intentions, not taking any money, as an allegation against him. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. You have here a second right that Paul refused. We read about that in verse 5. He was allowed to marry and have a family. And that is another right that the people who are involved with full-time work or even part-time work have a right as well. Well, if you have a right to receive pay, 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 4, and you have a right to have a family, 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 5, when you put those two things together, would you be able to conclude that it's also right for a congregation to support your family to the degree where all the needs would be met? Well, yes, those two things would go together. He had both of those rights, but he didn't use them. There have been some people, I'm thinking especially along the lines of Catholic teaching, who have taken the information in verse 5, and they have used that to say that people who are involved with religious work, think about, for example, Catholic priests, that it is right to have a companion who is not your spouse. So in these circumstances, there would be men who would take a woman, and they would be living in the same house. They would be their companion. Monks sometimes did this as well. And the women would be looked at as people who were assistants in missionary work. They were companions to provide company. They were people to help with some of the domestic things like cooking around the house. They were not wives. They were sometimes called sisters, beloved, companions. And justification for that practice is taken from the words lead about. And people will also sometimes affirm that wife can mean woman. And then to kind of top it off, there would be some people who would jump over to Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. And there you find that Jesus had some women who ministered to him. And they would say, aha, we've got women traveling with guys to meet the various needs. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 5. And Jesus did that same kind of thing. Well, let's unfold that and see how well it works as far as the truthfulness of it. It's true that when you look at that word which is translated lead about, it means to lead around with oneself or have oneself. It's also true, as you look at that word which is translated wife, that that can mean women. We have that back in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 5. But verse 5 is not talking about having some woman that is with a single and unmarried Christian preacher who is the traveling companion and serving various needs. When you look at Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, you find that Jesus did have the company of some women, but those people were also accompanied by the apostles. What happens if you have a situation where you have a guy, a Catholic priest, a monk, or someone else who is not married, and decides to take this woman and make her a traveling companion and do the various things that I discussed? Is that probably going to be problematic at some point? Yeah. All kinds of problems can erupt from that. If nothing else, it doesn't look like it's going to be a very righteous thing in the eyes of many, especially unsaved. And Paul said that we want to try to do that, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 15. We'll stop right here and see if there's anything that you want to add or ask.
How does you've got the American
ASV?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how does verse 5
read? It says, have we no right to lead about a wife that is a believer, even as the rest of the apostles and the brethren of the Lord in Cephas?
Because the New King James says no right to take along a believing wife.
Yeah, I think we're going to come back to that because of how that rendering is. I've got that highlighted, but if we don't, we'll pick it up. Anything else? Don?
Correct me if I'm thinking it wrong, but is Paul saying that he did not take any living funds from the congregation he was talking to?
The Corinthians, yes.
So is that any... He's saying that a preacher should not take money from congregations?
We're going to get to that too. So that's another really good question. Let's just table that for a little bit. We'll put it on the back burner. Anybody else? Okay, let's see what else we've got. As you look at verse 5, there are some practical points of application. First of all, is it acceptable for a man who preaches to get married?
Yes.
It is. Now, there are some people who don't believe that as long as the guy though is abiding by God's marriage law in Matthew chapter 19. We've already pointed out from combining verses 4 and 5 that if you are married, there is the right to pick up support for the families. And that, in a congregation, that's going to vary from place to place. There is no Bible passage which says pay people who are involved with this occupation or that occupation, one of which would be preachers, this much or that much. When you think about the golden rule, paying a guy enough to have a livable wage, that's consistent with what you find as far as the golden rule. That has not always been done in some places. I'll give you a couple stories here as far as things that have happened to preachers. I've never personally had a bad experience, but there are some people who have. There have been some people who have gone to a congregation, and when it came time to talk about salary, they were asked questions like, what's the minimum that you can get by on? If you're going to take a job, how would you like to be asked that question? How cheaply will you work for us? That just doesn't leave people with a warm, fuzzy feeling. There would be some other people who would word it slightly differently. Some people might say, how much do you need? Now, depending on how you ask that question, that might not be a bad question, but that can be asked in some bad ways. People have sometimes, as far as preachers, found some strange things happening when it comes to salary. Three quick illustrations. There was a fella, he's now deceased, but he let me know that when it came time for him to be paid, he never knew if he was going to get a paycheck or not on that particular Sunday. He did thankfully have some other sources of income, but he said there were times where he might go a month or maybe 6 weeks and he never got paid. It was just sort of at the whim of the treasurer. Well, if you were working a job, how would you like to know? You would probably like to know whether or not you're going to get paid or your expectations for a paycheck are going to be met. You wouldn't want to have several weeks, and this wasn't something that just happened once or twice. This was on a fairly regular basis. There was another fellow, from what I can tell, he was doing a good work. He was at a place for a long time, 10, 15 years, and he never got a raise. Now, again, a lot of people, if they were out there in the secular work world, that would not probably be a job that they would want to stay at. Then there was another fellow, and again, the stories just are legion in this particular area. He was working with the congregation, moved in, and part of his pay was a mobile home. The first night he was there, the floor fell in the bedroom. So you just are crash, and you've gone through the floor of the mobile home. And the brethren were not too concerned about that. It's just, well, you know, things happen and just deal with it. How would you feel if that were, you know, your family, your bed, and your nightmare? So a lot of congregations have gotten a lot better about this. If you go back a couple generations ago, you know, you have things like the depression. People were really suffering. There were some preachers who were definitely underpaid. And sometimes, you know, they were sent home, you know, with a couple chickens on Sunday. That was the pay. Well, that was thoughtful as far as some food. That probably was not going to pay too many bills. So congregations have gotten a lot better. This can be a sensitive area in a lot of places. And, you know, we're trying to hopefully have fairness when it comes to preachers and salary. Anything you want to add or ask on that before I move down a little bit more? That is correct. There are some congregations which are referred to as mutual edifying congregations.
In the church?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that belief says that we are opposed to having a located preacher, so we will mutually edify one another by various members. So you do have that as well. Okay, let's see what else we've got down here. Going back to verse 5 for a little bit, Paul's right to be married demonstrates that there is an error when it comes to Catholic doctrine and celibacy. You may remember from later in the book, 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 28, Paul says that God set the apostles first in the church. Now, if those set first in the church, the apostles, if they had the right to be married, what would be true for the lesser people in the church? Well, then if the greatest had that right, then of course the lesser would have that right as well. We're also told here that Peter had a wife. That's something that we could compare with Peter and Matthew 8 and verse 14. That verse tells us that he had a mother-in-law, and Peter and his wife, of course, could have been supported in church work. Then Paul also talks about the rest of the apostles. They were also entitled to have a marriage partner. Now let's talk about who a person who was an apostle could marry. In describing wives, Peter said that a believer could be the wife. If you have the King James translation, you'll see that the word is translated sister. Now, if you were to look at this, I guess, from one perspective, you might draw one conclusion. If you were to look at this from a different perspective, you might draw a different conclusion. If you look at the translation which says, Paul told the Corinthians, the apostles, himself, Peter and others, had the right to marry a believer. How much you understand that?
Well,
You have the right to marry a believer. Who would that be?
A Christian.
All right, it does sound like a Christian, doesn't it? So someone asks, were they required to marry a Christian? We've already studied that out in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. What we learn in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, is it permissible for a Christian to be married to a non-Christian? Yes or no? It is. Paul says don't separate. So at least from 1 Corinthians 7, from that vantage point alone, would it have been possible or permissible, maybe that's the better word, for an apostle to be married to a non-Christian? Yes. Now, if you were to say, if the passage were to read, someone says, have we not the right to read a book which is 100 pages long? What would that statement tell us, or what would that statement not tell us? Have we not the right to read a book that is 100 pages long? Well, okay, there would be that. That wasn't exactly what I was looking for, but that's a good answer. I was looking as far as the page count. Have we not the right to read a book that is 100 pages long?
Yes.
Okay, we do. Would you be able to take that statement and infer that you can't read a book that's more than 100 pages long?
You could.
But that would not be correct. So that's what people do here with, do we not have the right to read about a believer? Well, the answer is yes. But that doesn't exclusively mean that it would have to be a Christian. Now, having said that, what have we seen at this juncture with various other questions in the book? Paul said back in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 12, even if all things are lawful, not all things are expedient. If you were an apostle, how difficult would it have been to have been married to a non-Christian woman? It would have been very, very hard. So, I'd like to think that all the apostles, if they were married, they did have Christian wives that were faithful Christians. That, to me, would make a lot of sense, because they would be hindered in so many ways if that were not the case. But I don't know that we can say for sure that none of them were married to non-Christians, at least for a period of time. Anything that you want to add or ask before we go down a little bit more? Betty, and then Tim. I don't know that we've got, you mean Acts chapter 21, Philip with his virgin daughters?
Yeah.
He would have been the deacon, not Philip the apostle. So.
Okay. So we don't have any info that any of the other apostles
were married? I cannot call to mind, Betty, anything which would indicate the marital status of anybody else. Okay. You know, you wonder about the apostle John, for example. I mean, if he's around 90 years old, he's an old man, he's exiled to Patmos. Assuming he was married, what happened to his wife?
Yeah.
But if he was married and he was exiled, it's very possible that he had to split from his wife, at least for a period of time. So, I mean, it would have been very, very difficult. Tim, to you.
I have known personally a couple of people, guys, that were in the church, they were Christians in the church, and they married women who were not believers the way the Bible says that you become a believer, and they were pulled away from the church.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Pat Boone did that. He married a woman that ultimately pulled him away from the church. You know, my point is that can very easily happen.
Yeah. Well, imagine a woman who is not a Christian and married to an elder. Now, that is almost unthinkable when you look at the qualifications for elders, but again, it's something that could possibly come up in a congregation, and probably has at least a few times over the years, and it's just not a good fit. Dolores? Yeah, it's interesting how sometimes people will try to close the ranks by modifying some of the rules. The military is going through the same thing right now. The Navy is talking about people who have not gotten either GED or high school education. Before, that was unthinkable. You're not going to be allowed in. Or saying we might have illegal immigrants that we allow to enter into the service, or to do some other things, because we're short on numbers. And when that happens, you see that, whether it's in the religious realm or you see that in the spiritual realm, people making some really interesting and sometimes some very frightening compromises. But it happens, and we have living examples of that in a lot of different ways. Mom?
I've heard of instances in the past where a young man got into some sort of scrape with the law, and they give him a choice. You either go in the military or you go to jail. And a lot of them have gone to the military to escape going.
Yeah, there were some basically deferral programs, some alternative options. But now they're talking about, even in some cases, if you have a criminal record still just kind of, you know, it's already been processed as far as the courts, but perhaps waiving that, overlooking that, or to some degree setting that aside so that you can join. So you get back to trying to come up with enough people. At the end of verse 5, Paul referred to brethren of the Lord and Cephas, Peter's mentioned last. I find that interesting. If Peter was the first pope, you would expect him to be mentioned where in the verse? You would expect him to be mentioned first, right there at the beginning, but that's not done. When you look at Catholic doctrine, not to beat up on them, but what we're saying does apply, you find that, of course, Peter was married. So if you have a pope that's not married, you have to ask the question, why was Peter, in your estimation and in your system of belief, the first pope and he was married? You also have another Catholic error refuted in verse 5. When Paul talks about brethren and the Lord, what's he say? They were brethren
of the Lord.
Mary had other children. You read about that not only in Matthew, but you read about it in Mark, you read about it in Luke, you read about it in John, and you also read about that in the book of Acts. So five books are very, very clear, even Galatians chapter 1 and verse 19. Those brothers of Jesus, here Paul indicates that they had become involved with church work as well. And as you look at the verses that we're talking about, they should have been paid for their labor. What do you think Paul may have mentioned Peter specifically? He specifically mentions Peter. Why? Do you remember in the earlier chapters, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, or I am of Peter? It seems like at least some of the Corinthians were especially fond of Peter. Then when you get down to verse 6, you find that Paul said that he and Barnabas, he of course was another preacher, had the right or had the power, King James translation, to forbear working. Those preachers, they didn't need to work a secular job to support themselves because 1 Corinthians 9 says the preachers are to be paid. Betty, I want to see if this is coming back to what you were talking about earlier. The New King James translation implies that Paul and Barnabas did not have the right to forego secular employment. That says, or is it only Barnabas and I who have the right to not refrain from working? Was that the point that you're making earlier?
I think
that was Tim's?
No, Don's
point? Okay. All right, Don, let's pick it up, and Betty, if we need to go back to yours, we will as well. That translation kind of obscures the thought a little bit, but in the original text, it's really clear. Paul, in the Greek text, used two double negatives, and the sentence construction would be something like this. Do we not have the right to not go to the restaurant after worship? I'll say that again. Do we not have the right to not go to the restaurant after worship? What would the answer to that question be? Sure. I mean, we can either go or we can not go. We can stay home or whatever we want to do. We have that option. That's what Paul's talking about when he's talking about paying preachers. The obvious answer to that question is yes. If you don't want to do that, that's perfectly fine. So if you are involved with ministry, you are entitled to avoid working in the secular world so you can focus your time and attention on church work. We're getting to a point, at least this is what I can see as far as the church, where a full-time preacher is going to be a rare thing. Trying to find a preacher can be a real headache. Some congregations are literally searching for years. Some congregations have dwindled to the point where they are no longer able to afford a full-time preacher. And things are changing. We've kind of seen three different things. I told you about way back when the preacher didn't get paid well. He got paid with chickens. We've gone through a period where you have some places down south that have paid youth ministers $100,000 a year. That is a lot of money for a youth minister. And now we're kind of in this third wave or this third stage where congregations are, you know, trying to find a preacher, trying to find the funds to pay a preacher. And I think the future for a lot of congregations and a lot of preachers will end up being a guy who does full-time secular work and preaching on the side. And, you know, you have fewer and fewer people who are willing to do those two jobs. And that's probably going to be a big problem that we see within our lifetime. It's very possible that Paul and Barnabas had been singled out for some reason as preachers who did not deserve pay And that's why Paul deals with that here. So as you start looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul's trying to get the Corinthians to consider some things. Number one, had Paul and Barnabas worked less? Were they thinking that they were not entitled to pay because they hadn't worked as hard as others? Did the Corinthians think that they were somehow unfaithful? Had God somehow been displeased with their work? Was there something that obligated them to work at a secular job while other ministers like Peter did not? Anything that you want to add or ask along those lines? Tim?
You have to wonder if any congregation that maybe has dwindled to the point where they can't afford to pay a preacher a decent wage, then they also probably can't afford to do the benevolent work that they need to do.
Yeah.
Or the missionary work that they need to do. And then you gotta say, well, maybe you should work harder on getting new memberships so that you can do those things. Because, you know, the Bible doesn't say you're excused for not doing it. It wants you to do it, and you gotta do what you gotta to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there is always a need for new blood, so to speak. And if that's not there, eventually things will close up. There have been a lot of congregations, I think every week, if it's not within the Lord's Church, you can find another religious group, it simply closes. They get to the point, maybe they built a very large building, and they could have seated 1,000, you know, 500, and there was a split, or maybe things happen in the economy where people moved out, various reasons for the loss, and they got to the point where they're barely making utility payments or building payments, cut missions. They cut, they cut, they cut, and then eventually, I mean, some people remember Doug White? The congregation where Doug used to attend, it's gone. They just closed up. So, and you could just start going through the list as far as a lot of congregations, but we are seeing that. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. There are some places which are still sort of, you know, thriving, doing well, but there are a lot of congregations that are in a serious state of decline. And it's in 25 or 30 years, the church is going to be a very different place.
Sometimes you have a congregation that has some kind of turmoil going on in there, and it causes them to want to split.
Yeah, that happens.
What they should be doing is trying to settle their differences and not agree to split, because that's not the answer.
But in Galatians 5, Paul said, if you bite and devour one another, take heed that you be not consumed one of another. A lot of people have lived to actually experience that, Don.
I'm not questioning what Tim just said, but, you know, my opinion in going to a lot of churches and other places is that the number of people that sit in these pews is probably more so for the person that's sitting behind that pulpit than it is from the congregation. The congregation don't have any say, well, it's not my job, it's the preacher's job. It's all of our jobs, period. For the good preacher, preaching God's word is going to draw more people in than 10 or 15 or 20 members could do.
That is true. People will pay attention to the teaching that's done. I think that you see that represented with a lot of groups. There was a movement over the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years where the church kind of weakens the message to the point where it I guess, became more consistent with some of the things that society. You know, we see it a lot now with the wokeness and same-sex marriages, churches approving those kinds of things. And they will attract some people, but the folks that really want to do right, they are just not attracted to that kind of teaching. It's, you know, we can get this stuff from the world, so why on earth would we come to a religious group to basically get the same stuff? So people are looking for distinctive preaching and teaching, and that is one sign of a growing church.
Well, all we need to do is look at the mega churches. And most of those mega churches, they talk about the preacher, what he's done, how he's brought people in, how they've increased the buildings and all this kind of stuff. Not the congregation. Certainly the congregation has a lot to do with it. And the more people that come will draw other people, because they think, hey, something must be going on here.
Yeah.
If this is growing. So a preacher is basically the bedrock of the church from that standpoint, in my opinion.
Yeah. They do wield a lot of influence. And they can really help or they can really hurt. Brian and then Teresa.
I missed the class on the first three verses of the chapter. I'm just curious, how would you connect these questions in 4 and 5 and 6 and 7? When you think of the first three, my answer to them that's given to me is this. He asks these questions, these are rhetorical questions. How do these questions answer what he would be accused of? Whether I hear a challenge as apostleship.
Well, I think they were talking about Paul, and he lacked authority, he lacked certain rights. So Paul is trying to respond to that and say, look, I am an apostle, I have various rights, and the right to get married, the right to be paid. Yeah, these are the rights. All right, a little bit more before we get down to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. You have Barnabas being mentioned. This is the first time since the disruption that you have over there in Acts chapter 15, verses 36 through 40. Some think that this is sort of an incidental allusion to him. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not. You do see, though, here, I think, a high regard for this particular brother. You remember perhaps about Barnabas that he was willing to sell some possessions back there in Acts chapter 4, verses 36 and 37. People really thought well of him. It also looks like he was also unwilling to accept pay for the church work that he did. And, you know, maybe going back to some of the time that he spent with Paul on the missionary journey, he was able to fund that himself or picked up sources from somewhere else. You do have, as you look at this chapter, five reasons to pay preachers. The first one is back there in verses 4 through 6. Pay has been given for religious workers. We've just gone over that. Then you've got the additional ones in the following verses. Paul's going to talk about paying preachers from the perspective of soldiers. They're being paid. The people who plant vines, people who are shepherds, they're all paid for their efforts. Preachers should be put in the same category. 1 Corinthians 9:7, what soldier ever serves at his own charges? Who plants a vineyard and eats not the fruit thereof? Or who feeds a flock and eats not the milk of the flock? So you've got multiple illustrations to show that there are workers in various professions and they all deserve to be paid. He first goes back and talks about the soldier. If you enlist in the military, guess what? You get paid?
Yes.
You do. You think you get some other things? You think they're going to give you equipment? In fact, I went through some stuff recently and found some old military Air Force blues. And my last four numbers of the Social Security number were stamped on them. Guess they wanted me to know that they came from Uncle Sam. But Paul said that no soldier is going to go to war at his own expense. And if a soldier is treated in that way, then if you're a full-time soldier in the Lord's army, then you should also be paid. Now, stop here for just a second. Have there been some volunteer conflicts where people who were fighting did not get paid? Could you volunteer in? Yeah, you could, and that does happen from time to time. When you look at the word being a soldier, that's the present tense verb. It's translated go to warfare in the King James translation. And Paul apparently takes the secular term and brings it over into the gospel to talk about the Christian life. You have in 1 Corinthians 9:7 a rhetorical question that he should not be expected to work for nothing any more than a soldier should. When you look at that word for charges, it's a metaphor for the care owed to the apostle by the congregation. So this was something that Paul spent a considerable amount of time on. We'll look at another illustration or two and then stop and see if you've got some questions. Illustration number two is what? We've got the soldier. Now we turn to the person who plants a vineyard. If you're going to go out and work in a field, you're going to go out and put some grapes in, then you should be able to go out and draw from the produce. If you're the one who's out there that's producing that stuff, then you should be able to enjoy the fruits of the harvest. You have something similar back in Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 6, if you want a good cross-reference. If it is right for the fellow to get income from his crops, then if you're trying to plant and nourish a congregation, again, you deserve pay. Paul was someone who had helped nourish several different congregations, and again, the implication is, I deserve pay. Illustration number three is based on shepherds who cared for a flock. Paul says, and this is kind of interesting, you may or may not notice it, he said, for the shepherd, what do you get as far as the milk? You get to...
Drink it.
No, he doesn't say drink it.
Use.
Is that the word?
Drink of the milk.
Does not drink of milk.
Oh, anybody have eat?
Not. Oh, eat the fruit. Are you talking about the vineyard?
No, we're talking about the milk.
Oh, so
drink.
Drink.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Some translations say drink. Some other versions say eat.
You think,
okay, you think that's a mistake? Or you think there might be a reason that he says eat versus drink in some versions?
Well, if they made cottage cheese or butter.
Okay, if you're going to make butter and cheese, then of course you would be eating the milk. And that may be what Paul had in mind. We do know that shepherds were sometimes paid with a portion of the milk. if the people who are out there working with the flocks deserve compensation, then if someone is working with the flock of God, Acts chapter 20, verses 28 and 29, they also deserve compensation. Paul, when he wrote to Timothy, also talked about an elder being worthy of double honor, and an elder could also be paid for his work if a congregation so chose. Paul was someone who had nurtured a lot of different spiritual lambs, and again, it is an argument for support. When you look at the word which is translated feedeth, that same term is used over in Acts chapter 20 and verse 28 to describe elders. They feed the church of the Lord. When you look at these illustrations as far as daily life, you find that they're very easy to understand. The people, some of them probably had been shepherds. Some of them had probably planted vineyards. Some perhaps had been soldiers. So they would have been able to look at these analogies and say, yeah, that makes sense. So preachers, including Paul, Barnabas, Peter, and anybody else could have been paid. Anything you want to add or ask before we kind of turn the page here a little bit? Don, to you.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about the big Paul. Didn't Paul at one time tell his small congregation that he didn't want to basically take any money from him, he worked for himself?
You have Paul being the tent maker. I think that may be what you're thinking of, yes. That there were times where he supported himself. There could be times in his life where maybe some of the congregations were not sending money as often as they had. Maybe they were unable to do that. Ancient times, sometimes getting money from place A to place B was a slow process. You could be robbed. You think about the story of the Good Samaritan. So that, getting finances from place A to place B was a lot more difficult than now. So if Paul had a side gig, so to speak, that could have been very, very helpful for him. Setting aside some money for missionary works, there are a lot of different things that I think were probably helped by his working a secular job. So that still happens sometimes today. And as I said earlier, I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the future. Anybody else? Okay. If Paul has been arguing to pay the preacher based on various secular illustrations, and you have some people who are not too fond of him, as they became aware of that, can you see how they might object? I mean, people will object to just about anything if they don't like it. So how would some people object to Paul's argument thus far? Yeah. So, Paul, if you really want to be effective in your argument, where do we want you to get some illustrations from? You should be taking your... Yes, you should be taking your examples from the Bible, right? Well, inspiration certainly must have helped Paul, or maybe he was thinking along those lines. Betty, I didn't want to shut you down. Okay, you gave that answer. All right, so some have thought that Paul was perhaps too focused on paying preachers, and as you go back and you start looking, you can go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 1. He says, look, you have to realize that I am an apostle. There are some people who think, I don't believe that this is correct, but there are some people who would go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 1. They look at this chapter, and their argument would be that Paul is saying he deserved to be paid more than the average preacher. And he deserved more pay than the average preacher because he was an apostle. I don't think that's under consideration here. That just seems contrary to everything that you have in the chapter plus everything else in the New Testament. His point is, pay those who labor versus pay those according to the skill. When you think about that, we talked a little bit about as far as how much to pay the preacher, golden rule and so forth. Jesus taught in Luke chapter 10 and verse 7, a laborer is worthy of his hire and so forth. And we're going to talk about that just a little bit more. You find in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 6, Paul said that those who are taught have a responsibility to compensate those who do some teaching. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 16, Paul talks about, to some degree, the work of preachers and says that the people who hear them, they'll be saved by that teaching, and preachers also have a responsibility to themselves. Some, though, I think, and I don't think that this is maybe widespread, but there are some people who seem to have the idea that a preacher, once he becomes a minister, he's taken some kind of vow of poverty. Other people would say that he's preaching just for the money. I've known a lot of preachers, and like I say, some do make a lot of money, but generally speaking, if a guy is preaching, he's not in it for the money. One said, and I like the quote, the preacher teaches, though he must solicit his own classes. He heals, though without pills or a knife. He's sometimes a lawyer, often a social worker, something of an editor, a bit of a philosopher, an entertainer, a salesman, a decorative piece for public functions, and he's supposed to be a scholar. He visits the sick, marries people, buries the dead, labors to console those who sorrow and admonish those who sin, and tries to stay nice when criticized for not doing his duty. He plans programs, appoints committees when he can get them, spends considerable time in keeping people out of each other's hair. Between times, he prepares a sermon and preaches it on Sunday. Yes, preachers deserve to be paid. So there are a lot of things that go into the job, a lot of things that people perhaps do not realize or see, but Paul said that preachers do work, and generally that is true for the people who try to do that in life. All right, before we begin turning to the scriptures that Paul used, once again, I'll stop and see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. Tim?
After all those things you just listed there, I think that preachers back then were pretty much just like preachers now.
I would imagine.
And all those things that you mentioned that preachers now have to do, they had to do. All of those things. And if I might be presumptive in thinking what Paul had on his mind, but I got to think that he had those things on his mind concerning preachers, and he probably thought as a person, as well as an apostle, if a preacher that he knows is doing all those things, he doesn't have time to go out and do a secular job. And who's going to help him take care of himself and his family if it isn't the congregation? Because he's going to be super busy doing all those things. I can't imagine one of us trying to handle all of those things. So if you're going to take care of all those things, that's more than a full-time job.
Chris?
Well, and that's part of the problem in the church. The smaller the congregations, they still want a pay part-time, but they want all that stuff done.
Yeah, that is true.
That's why they're not finding preachers.
That is true. Yeah. There are smaller congregations that if you were to look at the job description, you would think, wow, even for a top wage, they are expecting a lot. And sometimes a congregation, you know, they're paying what somebody who's retired on Social Security might get. And they're, you know, they're shooting for the moon, and it's just not realistic. Mom?
I know of a church that was really destitute for a preacher. They'd been out of a preacher for a long time. And this one fellow applied for the job, and he started out saying he had to have an astronomical amount of salary. And, of course, the church kind of balked at that. He said, well, I don't really need it anyway. My wife is a professional person, and she earns more money than we can ever spend. But I just thought, basically, you know,
I'd ask.
I could get.
Yeah. Well, you do have some people who are sort of preaching for the money, and that would kind of fall in line with that. But a lot of guys, you know, are preaching for a lot less than they would make for the work at a secular job. And those fellas have the heart in the right place. It's not about the money. All right, let's see what we've got as far as 3 minutes left. Let's at least get started on the arguments from Scripture. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 8 through 10. Do I speak these things after the manner of men? That is my argumentation limited to those secular illustrations that I gave just a little bit ago, as far as a secular farmer and the person who is a soldier, those kinds of things? Then he asks at the end of verse 8, or saith not the law also the same? In other words, don't we have the same information in the Bible somewhere? Then he gets into Scripture. For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treads out the corn. It is for the oxen that God cares. Or saith he, assuredly for our sake. Yea, for our sake it is written, because he that ploweth ought to plow in hope, and he that threshes to thresh in hope of partaking. So Paul turns to the other side of the coin, so to speak, to justify paying preachers. He believed, when you look at Galatians chapter 4 and verse 30, that you see the same kind of thing. He believed that when it came to Bible questions, that people should be able to come up with a Bible answer. He did that. Jesus did the same kind of thing throughout his life. You have an example of that in Luke chapter 10, verses 25 and 26. Paul wants to make it very clear. Nothing wrong to teach from a secular illustration. Nothing wrong to use human wisdom. Jesus did that at times. But sometimes people get a better feeling if you can also put some Bible with it. And that's exactly what Paul did. Some people might have objected to his natural illustrations thus far. So Paul says, look, we'll take this a step further. That's quarter till. Anything, Brian? I'm going to stop it there and see what